This is the Elite Game Developers Podcast, a podcast about the entrepreneurs and investors who are building the games companies of the future. In April of 2020, I did a webinar on the topic of teams and team building in gaming. I went through how you'd start off building a founding team, and I covered the example of myself putting together my founding team back in 2012. Then I talk about the dream team in gaming, what that means, and how new founders should think about hiring to build the best team that builds the best games. Before we get into the lecture, here's a few words from our sponsor. We all know that developing a great game is one thing, but developing a great games business can be something else entirely. That's why some of the top game developers in the industry use ironSource's Game Growth platform, which takes care of both sides of the business, helping you monetize and to fuel your user acquisition. I for one wish we were using these guys in the early days of Next Games. You might also have heard of their Level Up podcast and a Medium blog. In terms of gaming content, this blog is up there with the best, featuring game industry experts talking all things game design, development, and growth. See for yourself by searching for ironSource Level Up on Medium or Spotify. So on to today's lecture. So thinking about my experience in building teams. So at Next Games, it was basically the founding team. I was the first person to start building the company. I was getting help from Samuli Syvähuoko, who's very known in the gaming industry. He helped me meeting up with founders, getting like people that I could talk to, like Jaakko Jumisko, who became our game tech lead founder. He had experience from starting games companies before joining the founding team of Next Games, so it was very cool to have him. And he was one of those people who at the early stage of Unity already knew all the ins and outs, because he was involved in Rothshard, which was I think one of the first console games ever built with Unity by Recoil Games here in Finland. And then I brought other founders involved into the team. That was my big experience there. I had a lot of learnings, which we'll talk about in this lecture, from working at Supercell and seeing how the founding team, how they had constructed the founding team, which I think was six people. And then at Iron Star Helsinki, I definitely started off with not knowing anything about team building, and I needed to learn everything the hard way. I started a company alone, brought on students who then kind of graduated to being the early employees of the company. And there was nobody really had any knowledge about making games or building companies. So I've really had a lot of learning experience there. Let's go to the first topic for today, which is the founding team. What does that actually include? Think about the team building. Why do I need a team? Why not just start alone? So I think that was the point that I most took away from founding Iron Star, is that it hurts a lot when you're alone and you need to deal with all the stress that a startup can bring in with yourself, and you don't have anybody who is kind of like sharing the load of figuring things out early on. So I really wanted to correct that with Next Games, and I brought on the founding team here because it made so much sense to actually have a lot of people who had similar interests, who owned a majority stake in the company, felt that they could contribute, and I could trust them as my team members in starting off. So before Next Games, how did I learn what I needed to know about team building? And the biggest observations that I was making at Supercell were around the founding team and how they operated, what they actually had there. So Supercell comprised of six founders. They had the CEO, who was Ilkka Paananen, who's a magnificent company builder, very motivated from the early days of founding Sumea, about 10 years before Supercell, and then merging with Digital Chocolate to run the Helsinki office for several years, and then having the kind of like inclination to actually go and found another games company with the creative director Mikko Kodisoja. They were the two people who started putting this team together. They brought on three technical co-founders, but not a specific CTO. So they didn't want to have this kind of like management team per se, but rather everybody was individually very high on strengths on their own area of expertise. And then they had one artist also joining the founding team and putting together the demo of the Gunshine game in the early stages. So if I'd start now to build a founding team, and what I saw at Supercell, what I saw at what we did at Next Games, that I think the number one criteria for me still is that I need to know my own skills and experience and the areas that I'm fond of working in. I need to kind of map that out and also kind of like feel that I can safely discuss these areas with any people, like what I'm like experiencing, that I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. Like, do you want to be the CEO? Or do you want to take an other role specifically tailored for your own experiences and where you can bring the most value into? And then who are the best people who are complementary to your skills? It's a lot of like understanding through your network who might be better, and what do you want? What are your ambitions, that you have an alignment there, that the whole founding team wants to create a big company, and it's really discussed beforehand, that it's obvious that everybody's aligned with ambitions. So I started with reaching out over LinkedIn, over Facebook with my contacts, and finding people that would really fit the role that I was searching people for. Let's talk about the dream team. What is that? You might have seen one of these teams in the news raising a huge round of investments. And all of these companies were basically formed under 6 months, or at least 9 or 12 months, before they raised this kind of huge round of investments. So how can this actually happen? What's going on there? Well, one of the things is that these people have started off with a leader who has superior experiences in starting off. So they've brought together their previous co-workers. They brought together people who specifically have the skills that you need people in the team. And then they've talked to investors that, hey, I'm thinking about doing something like this, and this is our team. And there's immediate appetite from investors to start putting money in. And what happens there is that you have this kind of dream team situation. Well, people who are in a dream team are people who've built and they've sold stuff at this kind of like A-class level. And there's an instant access for capital from them, for them from VCs, because they they're sort of like these magnets that, okay, if anybody who has this much knowledge goes into starting another company, there's going to be a lot of people backing them before they even start pitching. So they can raise a multi-million round with just having a prototype or a demo, which is usually the case that they want to kind of like go to that moment and then raise. And then things start looking like this, like 8 million, 9 million, 10 million raised. So this is a primary reason why gaming startups get funded, is that they have the dream team in the place. It feels like there's nothing in this group of people that is missing. So why wouldn't the investor bet heavily on these people actually succeeding? So what if you can't build the dream team? I think it's fine, but then what needs to happen is you need to start proving yourself in other ways. Like, for instance, like I get a lot of founders coming talk to me about, hey, we need to find a free-to-play expert. Where do I find a person like that? And I previously was trying to find people like that in my networks, putting them together with teams. But it sort of like dawned on me that why shouldn't the founding team that is already in place, that is missing a free-to-play expert, why aren't they educating themselves through all the material that's available online on free-to-play? It's not a big, actually, effort to start just, you know, looking things up, understanding what is free-to-play, how does it work. So I really recommend people to spend time to advance their own understandings of free-to-play, for instance, if you're going into that direction anyways. Like, why wait to find a perfect person to take sort of air quotes, take care of free-to-play? Why don't you do it yourself? Then structuring the team. You want to think about the founding team structure a bit there. Start thinking about the skills, bringing these learning machines into play. Like I just talked about the groups of people who should be learning, you know, free to play on their own, because they're anyways going to go into that area of business. Why not spend time and learn? But the learning shouldn't stop there. They should learn about how, you know, successful companies are built. You don't necessarily only need to look at gaming companies as examples, but rather look at really cool companies like Basecamp, Buffer, those kind of like very idealistic companies that might actually fit your own personality really well. So don't stop learning. And you want to find, if you're thinking about people for your team, your founding team, find those learning machines. And also, if you don't want to be the CEO, like if you in your gut you know that, it really makes sense to have somebody else who's going to be running that show. And then I'm thinking about this other person who needs to be in the team. Maybe it's you, who is the game design wizard. But what I'm here, like slicing the game design wizard or person who's going to be looking after the game, is this kind of like product plus data plus creative personality. Maybe it's one person, maybe it's two or three, but you need to have these in your founding team. And then the tech goes into this as well. Let's first cover the product and the data and the creative side. What this mean actually? So the product person, they're knowledgeable about the understanding of what is actually a product going to do once the game is created. What happens on the business side? How do you start looking into a product, a game making money? Understanding kind of like live ops, the lifetime of a player in the game. Are you attracting these people? Will they stay? What is your roadmap? There's a lot of things there, and it's very beneficial for for the product person to think about the vision of the product and how they describe the success, what does it look like, and also the failure situations. Can you navigate through the failures if the game, like how can the game really fail, and how, can you articulate that, and what are the ways of navigating the failures, and being on top of everything, like do you constantly understand what's going on. And it really is a definition for you as a startup founder to think about, this is how we're going to make money. So what is the product, the first product? What is the second one? Maybe you need to hire people before you start the second product. What does that look like? And then you have the data person. It's a really different kind of person who's going to look at analytics, but also on a different angle. So you need to know what data is relevant. I think this is the key here. So if you're coming from the outside of gaming, you might look really like somebody who knows how to dig stuff up, but the problem will be that you won't know where to start. In this similar situation, it's very beneficial that the data person starts studying the gaming, free-to-play, understanding. There's a lot of details online, and they shouldn't wait for somebody else to tell them what to look at. So it's very, very useful here. So I want to reiterate the kind of like thing here that like new startups, they're lacking a person with the free-to-play skills. They're going to get an immediate bounce from the investors. But how do you start learning it yourself? So I've talked about this fixed mindset versus growth mindset before in my lecture. So what is a fixed mindset? It's kind of like a, hey, we know everything we need to know about making games person who's saying like that. And then the fixed mindset person also agrees with this statement that I have a certain amount of intelligence and it doesn't really accumulate over time, or I cannot really force it other than learning by doing. But do you understand why certain games are doing well in the market? What are the underlying reasons that, you know, some game like Clash Royale is still doing so well after 4 years it came out? And also the fixed mindset person might be thinking that, hey, hyper-casual games, those aren't real games. We shouldn't make them. But when you have a growth mindset, you want to learn. You want to know that you can do better if you know more. And a growth mindset person also agrees with learning can significantly enhance my intelligence. So what I mean here is that it shouldn't be only about work experience that gives you the learnings, but rather research that you conduct before you take action. Then let's take a look at the creative person on the team. So this individual should think outside of the box, and they should know what matters for their player. On day zero, day one, day 30, day 90, the players are still motivated to come back. This is especially important in free-to-play. So if you're doing free-to-play, know why the best free-to-play games are making money for years. It's not about loot boxes. It's about some other motivations and goals that the players have. Think about those when you're starting to structure the team. Can the creative person think like that? And then we go to tech. It's an interesting field for sure. So you have hopefully somebody who's thinking in very, very many ways, more than just client or server, but they could do both, a full stack developer with a lot of experience. And I think the biggest positive here is that they have an appetite for entrepreneurship, so that they want to put themselves on the line to make sure that the company will succeed. Then let's summarize the founding team here. So founding team should have CEO, product data and creative personalities. Maybe it's one person or three people, but you have to have these involved. If you're thinking that, hey, we can't find a data person, then somebody needs to pick up that skill. Maybe it's even the CEO who's going to do that because they know SQL, they know something else, until you're at that point where you can actually hire somebody, until your business is big enough that you can pay a really proper data person to take on that role. And the same goes with tech. That's something you cannot really like do on the side. It needs to be somebody who's doing it full time. Let's go into hiring people. So what's applicable for hires when you're past the founding team situation? Well, the same things really matter, and I'm going to explain this a bit here now. So you hire by checking these personality traits. I think it's super, super important that you only hire nice people and honest people. Somebody who is kind of like feels that I would really love to be this person's friend. I think this cannot go like any further than explaining that you want people who would be who you'd like to have, like, you know, dozen people like them in the company. If you find that there is somebody who isn't really great, like who has personality problems, you definitely don't want them there because they will ruin your company. And you don't have to be the leader to be a leader. I think it's more about you have to, you can lead in everyday situations with your teams without getting a title or something. You want to find people who are thinking like that. And also that since you're in a startup in early stages, think about getting people in who are more interested in the future long-term outcomes and are willing to take a pay cut now and downgrade their lifestyle because they want to be involved so much. And of course that there's a chemistry, that they work really well with your team. You can figure that out through different kind of ways. So hiring for a culture, I really like what Stripe does. So this is from the CEO of Stripe, Patrick Collison. So before you make an offer to someone, think about whether you like to have 10 times as many people like them in the company. I think this is a really simple, good advice. The people you hire early on will be hiring the people in their teams, and these people tend to hire people like them. So this kind of extra test will help you make a decision when you're kind of like having mixed feelings about a candidate. And the one super important thing is to hire slow and then fire fast if needed. So you have a probation period first. So thinking about these kind of brilliant jerks, for instance, because it's better to have a hole in your organization than somebody who's an a-hole. So it's a great catchphrase of what is important to keep in mind. We tend to overestimate the negative impact of letting go of someone, and we ignore the damage done by leaving things as they are. So letting go of someone might shake up the team for a moment, but a couple of weeks later, your company will be in a much better position and everybody will see that the value of that decision, and it was a right call to do. Because otherwise you're going to start building a toxic environment, a toxic culture, and nobody wants to do that. And then thinking about starting off and building a leadership team, you might need to expand from your founding team to have somebody who comes in later on who is then the CEO. So oftentimes we have a CPO and a CTO, and we don't start off with having a CMO and a CFO, but then you want to expand to have those roles in place as well. let's talk about the tools that you'll need when you're building a team and building a company. What do you need for managing your people and building the right culture? Number one, you need all hands meetings. So there, you're constantly communicating to people and there's a dialogue going on. For you, you can measure where you are at with the company. It's like, and these questions that you should ask from your people are like, are we building a company or a game? You want to know what is the mentality inside the company and what do we want to achieve? What is our ambition? And ask your employees these kind of questions like, what do you suspect are the reasons we will fail? And that kind of like insight will be so valuable. So you're going to uncover things that people are already seeing, but they're too afraid to say. So those failure situations can really come up easily in these kind of discussions. And also for people who are leaving, ask them to highlight what are the reasons that they suspect that the company will fail. And secondly, I'm talking here about one-on-ones. So Mathilde Collin, the co-founder and CEO of Front from San Francisco, talks about their three different types of one-on-one discussions. If done effectively, these one-on-ones are an opportunity to show my team that I care about them, their professional success, and their overall happiness. It gives them an opportunity to step back and think about what they need to be successful and to hold me accountable for setting them up for success. So first off, she has three different kind of one-on-ones with people. So the first one is the weekly one-on-ones between a manager and an employee. So in these meetings, both of them discuss how what kind of progress has been made, and they look to unblock any issues and to ask and answer questions. The goal of these one-on-ones is to ensure that people are working on the right things and that they understand why their work matters for the business. Secondly, they have monthly one-on-ones for a pulse check on happiness. There's a survey sent out a few days before this one-on-one asking what the employee is happy and unhappy about, what they'd like to be better at, and what are they proud about, etc. The manager reads these responses a day before the one-on-one in order to prepare for that meeting. And then the third one is their career development one-on-one. So this is very important to kind of like have at least every 6 months, because in these moments, the manager and the employee meet up for a discussion on career development. The questions around the employee's role, what kind of careers they admire, and where do they think their own career will be in 6 months, 2 years, 5 years, so that there's a roadmap in place for the company to help this person, this employee, to reach these career goals. So the manager and employee work together to identify what are the growth opportunities, and they both commit to the next steps of the employee's desired career path. And thirdly, there's vision, mission, and core values. So often something that gaming companies start worrying about when they hit like 12 people or more. So I suggest you should start early, the better you will be off. So why is that? I believe that the vision and mission determine why the company exists. Where do you want to be in 3 years? If you can describe that, you'll have a vision that you can then work backwards from to see how you're going to get there. So why does it really matter for smaller companies to have this in place? Well, I think an individual will have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. So that's why you have to have a vision and mission for people to go after. So I would say that in startups, the main reason for failure ever is giving up. So why would you give up? One of the things is not seeing the progress or the game failing to become a commercial success or even viable business. But in a sense, like, you might be in a dark room trying to find a light switch to actually get somewhere because you don't know where you are, where you're going for. Without a vision and mission in place, it might just be, you know, it's this game and then we don't know anything what will happen afterwards. Like, if you're building on top of that kind of future, it can be very short-sighted. Like, where do you see the company in several years time? So if you have a mission, a just cause, a belief that's bigger than you, you will never want to fail. You will want to get going and continue. So it's very crucial then to not confuse the company mission and vision with your product's mission and vision. So these are two different things. There are many companies nowadays that have more than one product being developed and or maintained. And it's really important to have a mission and vision defined for each of these. And for gaming, that means the game products that the company is making. So point number four. Now we're getting into something super interesting. We're talking about Pixar's Brain Trust. I think this is one of those tools that are underutilized in gaming. So if you think about like how Pixar uses this tool, Ed Catmull in his book Creativity Inc. talks about this thing that how do you get a director to address a problem he or she cannot see in their film? So in Ed Catmull's book, he wrote, a mystifying plot twist or a less than credible change of heart in our main character is often caused by subtle underlying issues elsewhere in the story. So the brain trust will point out an issue and then allow the director to figure out the problem on his or her own comings afterwards. So most importantly, of course, is that the film is under review, not the filmmaker themselves. So the brain trust, in a sense, is a hallmark of a healthy creative culture. That is, its people feel free to share ideas, opinions, and criticisms. The brain trust has no authority. They can give candid feedback, like this kind of people who really know what they're saying, what they're doing. They're brought into the meeting to hear out the director, and then they give feedback, but the director does not have to follow any specific suggestions. So after the brain trust meeting, it's up to the director to figure out how to address the feedback. So why would the brain trust be useful? So in a sense, you're a product owner now in a games company. You're leading a game team. So the question is, how do you get a game lead to address a problem he or she cannot see? So as the company grows, the schedule usually drives the output and not the strengths of the ideas. So think about this candor that's happening. Well, if you're in a one-on-one discussion, it's usually pretty open. But when you're in a group, your animal instincts start to kick in, the fear takes over. So we want to have this secure place where people can give opinions. And like Ed Catmull says that, you know, you are not your idea. And if you identify too closely with your ideas, you will take offense when challenged. So the candor could not be more crucial to our creative processes. Ed Catmull says. So why is that? Because early on, all of our movies suck. That's a blunt assessment, but I choose that phrasing because saying it is a softer way. It kind of like, it wouldn't convey how bad the first versions really are. So how do we apply a brain trust into gaming? Well, what Ed Catmull says is that you can start your own brain trust by choosing people that make you think smarter, putting lots of solutions on the table, and finding people who will level with you. So the brain trust is made of people who have a deep understanding into building these products, who usually have been through the process themselves. So starting off with game designers, product people, then carefully expanding. So a brain trust could evolve a lot in the future, like Catmull says that they evolved from a tight, well-defined group working on a single film into a larger, more fluid group. So over the years, the ranks grew to include a variety of people like directors, writers, head of story, whose only requirement was to display a knack on storytelling. And how do you uphold a brain trust? Well, you need somebody who owns the brain trust. Catmull says that while I attend and participate in almost all brain trust meetings, I see my primary role as making sure that the compact format that they have for the meetings is well protected and upheld. So you can't really totally eliminate the blocks of candor, the fear of saying something stupid, looking bad, or offending someone, getting kind of like in these kind of combating situations. They might hold you down. But if these situations warrant the candor, you must address people squarely. Then we go into crunch, which is very much a problem in gaming. So, like, I've heard this saying often from people who are running games companies that we're not going to crunch, and then we always crunch anyways. So what really is going on there is that, you know, you have things coming up that are not anticipated, and game projects take longer, and then it's just you go into crunching mode anyways. So of course, there might be periods where people are working late and they want to be excited about what they're working on. But then there are times when they come in late and they seem to be like this distracted and disinterest. So it's impossible to find alignment with the whole team. Usually there's different people who react to stress and more work differently. And there's, of course, different kind of cycles of people waking up and sleeping differently. And that's, I think, the biggest problem with crunch is that you cannot really align it with everybody. And all of these have an impact on the way that people work and the type of work they want to do and how long they want to do it for. So do we need to get rid of crunch? Well, I think we should. But how do we get rid of it? I think one of the big opportunities is not to do any big launches. So the big opportunity is now in mobile games, since user acquisition-driven game development has removed the reliance of App Store featuring, which usually happens when the game's launched. You're losing this sense of urgency, but in a good way. The crunch doesn't create now any kind of burnout because you're trying to hit a date with Apple and Google Play, and people won't leave, and they will stay with you, and they'll be more happy because you can more iteratively launch these games. And number six, financial incentives. What are they and how do they work? So, of course, you have salary and stock options. Like I just this week brought out an article regarding stock options for games companies. So having a big financial bonus could actually be detrimental because it changes the motivation. All of a sudden you're thinking about something that might happen short term, but like usually in creative work, financial bonuses aren't that effective. It's really hard to tie the financial reward for what you're creating. Like creativity is sort of like not something that's very well aligned to finances. So think about transparency here. If you have people who have a certain salary, why is that happening? Why are some people getting stock options? Talk about them as early as possible. Share these policies with people that are coming on board. So if you really want to look up at some really cool ideas for good financial incentives, head on over to Buffer's blog. They're a San Francisco-based company who creates scheduling tools for people who use social media. So they really write a lot about their transparent culture. So the final aspect I'm going to be covering today is a safe environment at work. So what does that mean? There's certain things which come up a lot. So vulnerability, like showing vulnerability. What is that if the leader is showing vulnerability? It means that they're creating an environment in which people feel safe to raise their hand and say, I don't know what I'm doing. Sort of like pointing out that I need help. Can you help me? So leaders should practice this kind of empathy instead of asking, how do I get the most out of my people? They should be asking, how do I help my people to be at their natural best when they're at work? So make sure the leader is vulnerable first and often. Laszlo Bock, the ex-head of people analytics at Google, recommends leaders ask their people three questions. What is the one thing that I currently do that you'd like me to continue to do? What is one thing that I don't currently do frequently enough that you think I should do more often? And what can I do to make you more effective? And you really want people to over-communicate the ways of cooperation. I think that also creates this environment of trust and vulnerability, that people are open to talk to each other about the expectations, and also like the expectations of the cooperation. It won't happen on its own, so the leader should define the collaboration elements for helping others and model it out so that there is the understanding for what the vulnerability, for instance, should mean. And deliver the negative stuff in person. If you have negative news or other feedback to give to someone, even as a small thing, it should happen face to face. So this creates an understanding and clarity and connection. So a one-on-one culture and a one-to-many. So again, the all hands and also the one-on-one environments. There's a book called The Culture Code. In that book, author Daniel Coyle talks about these two critical moments. So when you're forming new groups, focus on two critical moments. A, the first vulnerability, and B, the first disagreement. These small moments are the doorways to two possible group paths. Are we about appearing strong, or are we about exploring the landscape together? Are we kind of like about winning interactions, or are we about learning together what is going on? So those are kind of like interesting spots from that book that I really want everybody to take home with them. So summary of today's lecture. The summary of the tools for building great companies and great teams is that you conduct all hands meetings, make sure you're communicating, and it's an interactive process. Then one-on-ones, where two people are talking, create really good processes over there. I was talking about three different ways that you can do that. And then really well map out your vision, mission, and core values. Then take a lot of utilization from Pixar's Brain Trust to see if you have issues in developing your games and how you can really like point out problems in the products. And then think about crunch policy, how much overtime should people be working when they're delivering creative products as games. And then the financial incentives, do you want them to kind of think about short-term or long-term incentives? There's a lot of nuances there for sure. And then the safe environment, kind of creating the vulnerability and also all the processes related to that. So thank you guys for this lecture. I hope it was really interesting for you. Head on over to Elite Game Developers and subscribe to the newsletter to get more information directly to your email. Thanks again. Bye-bye. That's it for this week's episode. If you like our content, please do hit subscribe or follow on your podcasting app. And also, sign up for our mailing list. You'll get our Friday newsletter, which contains something super interesting for people who are interested in founding games companies. Check it out and sign up on elitegamedevelopers.com. See you next time. Bye-bye.